I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum. Welcome back, Martin.
It's fantastic to be here, Michael.
It's a lovely, wet, windy day in Fremantle, and we've got quite a bit to talk about. It doesn't have a particular theme to it, Martin. It must have been the sort of set of issues that Jackson Pollock took to his studio with him before he set about painting the blue poles. There's a bit of this, there's a bit of that. It flicks around. I'm not sure if it creates a picture. And if it does, probably not a very pretty one. But starting in no particular order of preference, Boris Johnson, he walked the plank before the committee report came down saying he misled Parliament. Rather a scathing report. Martin, does that sort of thing ever happen in Australia? If there were a committee report saying you misled Parliament, would you be gone?
It does. It does. And it's happened a number of times. But with Boris Johnson, he would have seen a preview of that report, and that's probably why he's pulled the pin, because it is incredibly damning. It's saying, as Prime Minister of the UK, no less, he repeatedly and deliberately lied to Parliament, including on, and especially on, all the COVID rules and how he was flaunting them. And this is when the whole of the UK is locked down quite strictly and people's individual liberties are being curbed repeatedly. And then you've got the Prime Minister, no less, the leader, that is holding parties. And, there's a completely different set of rules for him. So when you look at it through that lens, it's pretty outrageous what went on. And it's no wonder that a lot of people feel aggrieved, including many MPs in his own party. I think a lot of them would just want to move on. And I wouldn't be surprised if you get a lot of those Tory MPs endorsing the report wholeheartedly and draw a line under that error. Because you can't say one thing and expect one thing of all the people and do the opposite yourself.
In Parliament, in the Westminster system, as it is often called, the British model that we've adopted here, not telling porkies in Parliament seems to be a pretty critical issue, Martin.
It is. This is, by convention, this is a hangable offence because you have a duty. You swear an oath when you go into Parliament, when you appear before one of its committees, that you'll speak the truth. Now, I've appeared before parliamentary committees. You've been in lots of circumstances previously professionally, Michael. You take your oaths very, very seriously. So misleading Parliament is a major offence, and this report indicates he did this repeatedly. So we know that politicians are flexible with the truth, but when you do that in Parliament and it's demonstrated and when there's evidence to that effect, you're in a lot of trouble.
There's a sort of a flip side to this in some sort of conceptual way, and that is the entitlement of a member of Parliament to get up in Parliament and to make what seem on the face of it to be all sorts of outrageous statements, and to do so under the cloak of parliamentary privilege. They can't be sued in a court for what they've said in Parliament. And it comes up in many contexts. The Tasmanian representative, Andrew Wilkie, has used parliamentary privilege a lot, particularly in relation to the gambling trade and other areas. The most recent example of it, of course, is Senator Lydia Thorpe, who said she'd been, according to her definition, sexually assaulted, and a lot has happened. How does parliamentary privilege work? Are there limits to it?
It's a really good question, and I think a lot of people outside the sort of parliamentary bubble may not understand or appreciate it. Parliament was always envisaged as an area where you speak the truth to power and where you hold people accountable. It's elected. And so freedom of speech is part of that, where it's a forum that you can raise anything and you can speak freely without fear of defamation. Bearing in mind, defamation is a very common thing. We've seen it thrown around left, right and centre, most notably by Ben Roberts Smith. But there's been plenty of successful defamation cases. So this is the power of parliamentarians to raise things in an unfettered way. It's not completely unfettered. So we just talked about how if you mislead Parliament, you can be held liable for that, and that can actually land you in the Privileges Committee, and they can take action against you. And that's what's caught up with Boris Johnson. So it's not unfettered, and sometimes if people behave inappropriately in Parliament, they can be censured accordingly. There's also some measures in some parliaments to allow people that are named adversely to respond on the record through a statement to Parliament. And there's a process in the WA Parliament for that as well. So if a parliamentarian gets up there and says, you're guilty of this, this, and this, and you can't sue them or have any recourse, you can still put in a statement that says, I reject utterly those accusations. Coming to Lydia Thorpe, I thought this was a fascinating example of parliamentary privilege. She got up and said that she had been sexually assaulted and harassed and a number of other things. And initially people seemed pretty sceptical or scathing, and you had to withdraw those comments, and the individual named was quite outraged. But subsequently, a number of other people have come forward with similar allegations. That doesn't mean that person's guilty. You've got to be very careful about those things. But what that does say is, that there can be some benefits in raising things in a forum like that, and that MP is no longer sitting in the Liberal Party room as a result. So it's a really interesting power. It sometimes gets abused that parliamentarians have that the rest of us don't.
Martin, it's been a pretty unseemly sort of week in many ways in the federal parliament this last week. We all know about the Brittany Higgins allegations for some time ago. There was a trial which was terminated due to the conduct of one of the jurors. There's an inquiry with a report to come down shortly out of the ACT and the circumstances in which the prosecution took place. And then most recently, the personal text messages, it seems, of Brittany Higgins or people connected with her have been somehow leaked to the media, and they're turning up, and people like Katie Gallagher, a senator for the Labor Party and a minister, is being asked what she knew about this and that. What have you made of this flow on from the Brittany Higgins allegations this week?
I think from the start, the Brittany Higgins case has been politicised. So it's not new. It's been politicised all along. I suppose, sadly, that was inevitable because we're talking about a rape allegation that allegedly occurred in a ministerial office, the office of a Minister of the Crown, and involved ministerial staffers, and whether it was reported and what was done and all those sorts of things. So sadly, it was always going to be politicised. And we've seen that play out again. And I think that it's really incredibly disappointing that those text messages got leaked because, if you're the accuser or the accused, you would say that justice has not been served in this case at all. So neither party is satisfied. With the Finance Minister, Katie Gallagher, though, there is actually a genuine issue there because, again, in parliamentary estimates, where you swear an oath to tell the truth, she said she had no knowledge of those, and quote, no one had any knowledge of any of these accusations before they were made public. There appears to be some evidence to the contrary. So there are legitimate questions that she has to answer there. Notwithstanding, like I said, all of that, the disappointing element of the politicisation of that whole case.
We'll no doubt hear more about that as it moves along, but it just goes to show how the real business of Parliament can be in many ways sidetracked by some of these allegations. And there's a degree of not entertainment, but prurient interest in the whole thing. Someone turned 77 during the week. Donald Trump, the day that he was arraigned for not doing the right things with state secrets. It's just another act in the play, I suppose you might say, another act in the drama, whatever series of the reality show it is, Martin. It's got a way to go, do you think?
Oh, I think it's got a way to go. If I was making some tips, I would say Trump's lawyers are going to drag this out all through the presidential campaign, and it won't be resolved when voters go to the polls at the end of next year. That's what I reckon, with as many cases as possible. And all the while, he'll be telling everyone that he's a victim, that it's a conspiracy, that it's politicized, and it's all designed to stop him from running for president. Notwithstanding, there are some very serious charges there, whether he's guilty or not. The most serious one, I think, is probably the fact that he's alleged to have had nuclear secrets, no less, at his own home. And when this was brought to his attention, that he obstructed investigators and sought to mislead them, etc. I mean, that's pretty extraordinary. Yeah, pretty extraordinary allegations. So, but it doesn't really matter how extraordinary the allegations against Donald Trump are. He will still maintain that they're politicized, it's a witch hunt, that it's that he's really the victim here.
Martin, using Blue Poles analogy, we keep flicking and pouring the paint in this direction and that direction. There is a rough free speech thread to it all this morning. And there's also talk of prohibiting gambling ads on the media. The Guardian today have just sent out a letter and posted stories to say that internationally they're no longer taking any gambling ads at all. And there are big pushes in the federal parliament. Zoe Daniels is pushing hard for it as well. And Peter Dutton, the Liberal Party opposition leader, has also made comments which suggest at least a partial support of a gambling ban. Where do you think this is going?
I think it's going one direction. And the question is how long it takes. But broadly, you'd have to argue that that the tide's going out, that the gambling ads, sooner or later, people are going to take action to ban them or disassociate themselves, companies disassociate themselves with them because of the harm that gambling causes. We had this at the New South Wales election earlier this year. I think we talked about it, didn't we, Michael? It was a big platform of the then Liberal government. I think they got a bit of traction on it. They lost the election. But I think it was actually pretty popular at the time from people I spoke to in New South Wales. And I think it'll keep coming up again. It actually is one of those strange things that combines people worried about disadvantaged people and also social conservatives. So it actually, there's support on the left and the right for this in different ways because the conservatives are worried about its impact on families. And, some people on the left are really concerned about its impact on disadvantaged people because they're the most vulnerable and the most exposed to it. So I think there's elements of support across the board for it. And famously, at the New South Wales election, a lot of Labor's own unions wanted them to back the Perrottet proposals. It's watch that space, Michael. I think it's going to grow in momentum.
It's an interesting one. I can remember vividly, really, from my youngest times being told by my parents not to drink spirits and not to gamble. And it strikes me every time I see a gambling ad during the footy, it seems just incongruous and inappropriate. So I'm voting to ban them. But one thing that...
You're really an old school conservative, Michael, when it comes to that.
Oh, I think that's well known, Martin. One thing that we would like to ban but are struggling to do so is the Ukraine-Russia conflict. We've been told there's going to be an offensive or a counter-offensive by Ukraine. We're told there's something going on. We're told that townships are being reclaimed. I'm not sure what a township looks like in eastern Ukraine. It's probably already a bombed pile of stone. But what is the strategy? Is it evident? Where's it all going, or is it all PR?
There is a counter-offensive of sorts. I think both sides have acknowledged that and said that it's happening. It could be quite difficult because Russia's positions are quite entrenched now, and Russia's been expecting it for a long time. There's some obvious places for it to happen, so they've reinforced their positions. Their fallback from Kherson was actually about reinforcing their position south of that river. And so I'm... I think that it could be really tough going. It appears that that's the case so far, that there's been some small gains, but not big ones to date. And this is when Western firepower is being brought to bear, and you're hearing all these stories about increased military aid to Ukraine at the moment to try to enable them to break through, including training Ukraine pilots to fly F-16s. Not the latest version, but a pretty advanced version. So the next couple of months are going to be really interesting, because if Ukraine does make headway, that's could significantly alter the status quo. And if they don't, I think it's just a protracted quagmire and nothing will change for a long, long time. And so watch that particular space. I think you asked where, and the most obvious place is in the south around, because that does actually break the Russian supply line and cuts off the Crimea from their eastern Ukraine territories. So I think that's going to be a key site.
So looking at the months ahead there, we're also, Martin, to complete this Jackson Pollock Blue Poles piece this morning, got something else that's a few months ahead, and that is the referendum on the voice to Parliament and the executive. The latest polls suggest, depends on how you read polls and how they're prepared, that the yes case support is waning to some extent. What do you make of those polls? Can we take them at face value? And presumably it does mean there's work to be done if the yes case is to get up.
Yeah, look, I think you do take note of those things, because they do provide, they're not the be all and end all, but they do provide us with some sense of public sentiment. There's a couple of things there. I think partisanship is always a big problem around referendum time, because very few referenda ever get up without bipartisanship. I think it's possible, but extremely difficult to do that when major parties are opposing a referendum idea. So that's one issue. And I think it is falling into that sort of left versus right dynamic, which is a shame, because it's supposed to be about bringing people together. But if you look at the polling numbers, you're seeing really strong support amongst Greens and Labor's voters, and much less support. Still in the 40s, you know, it's not impossible to attract coalition supporters, but they're less likely at the moment, according to the polls. So that's the key area, whether there's some people on the moderate side of the Liberals that might come out and speak forcefully in favour of the voice is another potential development that could change things. A bit like the marriage plebiscite, where significant, including the Prime Minister, significant numbers of Liberals spoke in favour of it. So if I was the Prime Minister, I'd try to find a few allies on the Conservative side, your Gillian Leases and others, get them more involved and try to drive a bit more coalition support, because they're a really significant component of community. And so watch that space. There's still that question around whether there might be some detail released on the model. Even though it's a question about the Constitution, a question about principle, that's another issue that could be addressed in coming months.
Martin, I think that completes our not as pretty as blue polls picture of politics this last week for today. It's, as always, been informative, not from my side, but from yours, and our listeners will be pleased to have heard just what you've had to say today. Thanks for being here. See you next week.
Always a pleasure, Michael.